This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the January 17th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm amused. This is just such an inside production joke, but the theme plays loud enough in my headphones that I really get a chance to rock out there. And it didn't seem to have quite the faith that it usually does. I felt like I was competing with the background music there. But it is the January 17th, 2017. I have to keep saying that so I don't get the year wrong. Edition of the DRF Players Podcast, show 204. My name is Peter Thomas Fornital. I'll be your host for the next hour, joined by the usual crew. We have from the DRF offices in New York, Mr. Mike Hogan.
Hello.
And we have back, I think the jet has landed after an exciting weekend in Lexington, Kentucky, back on planet Texas. And I think he's back in the office today. Isn't that right, Jonathan Kinch?
I am in the office, doing, I'm doing the quote fingers, doing work.
I was going to say, the first question I wanted to ask you actually is, with the National Handicapping Championship and its $2.5 million expected purse, at this point, just over a week away, isn't it? I was wondering if when you're in the office, the balance, and I know that your business partner listens to the show, so I'm very curious how you answer this question, what the balance is at this stage of the year between your proper work that you're doing for part of your business and how much you're looking to create track profiles at Oakland.
No, it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both. The funny thing about it is that my business partner and best friend, Robert Chow, is in between houses. He's moving into a new place soon, and he happens to be sleeping at my house as we speak. So he officially can't say anything about what I'm doing today. So.
Well, I hope Robert joins us out in Las Vegas. He is legendary for his taste in wine. I've had some very good experiences out there sharing good Piemontese wines with Robert and the gang. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to do that again. In all seriousness, though, how good are you feeling about your preparations for the NHC in just over a week's time?
I feel fine. Like, you know, what we talked about before in the past, the last 2 years, I did extensive preparation starting back at least in December at some point, both years. The first year I was so mentally exhausted, but I was so scared and nervous because it was my first one and I wanted to do so well. It kind of carried me through. Last year I wasn't as scared and nervous. The adrenaline didn't carry me through and I was just beat by the end of it. So I decided this year that I'm going to treat it like any other day. And you know, when Fairgrounds draws on Friday, I'll put my head down then. But until then, I won't be doing anything. I'm going to do a little bit at Golden Gate just because I feel like it's a forgotten place. And if I can find one there, I will. But other than that, Aqueduct, Gulfstream, Tampa, Santa Anita, all those ones, I'll wait until they draw.
How does the change in days of the NHC? Last year, it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday. This year, a return to Friday, Saturday, Sunday. How does that change the preparation in terms of when tracks draw? When can you start getting serious? And how different is that than it was last year with the earlier first day?
And I'll tell you what, it makes it really tough. The great thing about last year was is that the Thursday races are drawn on Sunday. So you have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday to look at the Thursday races. Fairgrounds draw 7 days out. I think that's just a Louisiana rule. They draw 7 days out. So you would have that the Thursday prior to the Sunday where everything else draws. So essentially, by Tuesday last year, I had Thursday completely done. So that when Wednesday rolled around and they drew for Tuesday rolled around, they drew for Friday and then Wednesday for Saturday, you know, I was kind of tackling those then. Now it's going to be a little bit different, right? Because I'll still get the Fairgrounds draw on Thursday, but then everything else isn't going to draw until Tuesday.
Bit of a fire drill come Tuesday.
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit tougher. And I'll already be out there, so I'll be Ubering around Las Vegas trying to find a FedEx Kinko's that can print to my satisfaction. So either that or I'm going to pack my own paper and hope that I can convince some of the people at the NTRA to let me print. Actually, I joke. think Office Depot or something is like sponsoring. I feel bad if it's Office Max, but it's Office something is kind of sponsoring it to. They're gonna have a little print station set up, so I think that you'll be able to do your printing there.
Mike Hogan just cringing the years he spent in Portland, Oregon, especially not wanting to kill trees, hearing us talk about this. And JK, you're not talking about ordinary printing here. I'm an 8.5 by 11 guy myself. What size? I've seen you walk around with those things. You look like a football coach on the sidelines. What size are the pages that you like to print?
I like legal for a normal day. A normal, regular old day. I'll take the legal size paper. When it's a big day and there's going to be lots of looking, the legal paper and some of the print that we have is a little bit small, so I'll go ahead and bang out the tabloid size paper, which is 11 by 17, and I'll do that from time to time. And that's probably what I'll do at the NHC. It's going to be a lot of PP staring for 3 days, and I think I'll take it easy on my eyes.
Do you, when you're talking to the person next to you, do you have your headset on and do you hold the 11 by 17 sheet in front of your face to prevent lip reading?
Absolutely. I can't let anybody know what's going on, especially the Baychok table, which is a good transition.
Yeah, talk about that. Talk about this. Are you guys reviving your table bet from last year's NHC?
Yeah, we're just betting cheeseburgers, right?
All right.
But last year we had a table bet where table 69, which was the table I was sitting at when I got two to the final table. So that became our lucky table since I've done the best at our table at the NHC. So we sit there, table 69, me, Nick Tamaro, Jack Jenkins was there last year, wasn't playing, Blake Jesse, Robert. We were playing against Mike Baychok, the former NHC champion, and his brother Benjamin Baychok, and then their table. And it was a revised, best four scores versus best four scores. For a couple of cheeseburgers. And so this year we'll be doing the same thing, but we have a new addition to our table 69. Officially, he's been there the last 2 years, but now the famous Philly Joe will be actually joining us with a tournament entry card with his outright NHC win on DRF Qualify this weekend.
I did see Philly Joe's name up at the top of those standings. He's on my list for a player to talk to, maybe for a piece on Friday. Great guy, horse owner. Very passionate about the game, very excited to have him in the NHC mix. Of course, there are two more opportunities to qualify online to join JK at the NHC, maybe join in a table bet of your own against him and his boys. Go to tournaments.drf.com. There are feeders. I don't think there's Wednesday feeders this week. I think they're Thursday, Friday, since we had some yesterday. But go to tournaments.drf.com. Check it out. You can feed in for short money and play in either the Saturday or Sunday events and still have a chance to win your way to the National Handicapping Championship. We're going to do a little bit more on the NHC. We have a reader question that we're going to get to later in the show, but I think we should segue into talking about some of the weekend's racing. Let's start off by talking about the three-year-old division. Yesterday was the Smarty Jones with the uncontested living up to his name. Mike Hogan, what were your thoughts on the performance?
Oh, well, it was good, and it was in the slop. And, I think Jonathan and I both kind of saw it as a two-horse race going into it, and it was kind of run as such with Petrov running a clear second. I think those are the two you'd want out of the race. I don't know what to make of it with it being a wire job and on a sloppy track. He'll kind of have to prove it to me, but he looked pretty good. And I think ultimately what it does is it just flatters McCracken, who beat him in the prior race down at Churchill. And I think a lot of people are going to be looking forward to his 2017 debut.
96 buyer speed figure for uncontested. JK, what were your thoughts on the performance?
What's funny is when we talked about the race, I just kind of blasted through it when we talked about it, and I forgot the trip note that I had on Petrov. I didn't see it before we talked about it. And so my enthusiasm yesterday kind of switched a little bit towards wanting to have an opportunity there, thinking uncontested might be a one-turn horse. Not a one-turn horse, but be better ultimately as a sprinter.
And we need so that sounder, Mike. We need
that sounder. I know.
Get on it.
I'm going to interrupt JK for a second. I wish there was a way I could like auto search the archives for every time, JK equals one turn horse race, we'd probably get about 40 or 50 hits over the span of however many podcasts the band's been on.
Sorry to interrupt you there, John.
Oh, no, it's fine. Not a problem. It was deserved for sure.
And then alternately search for two turn horse, and we'd probably get like two hits.
But anyway, so I got very excited about Petrov, and I kind of wanted to play around there. And then as I dug deeper, I noticed that Rowdy the Warrior, the reason I bring him up is the four horse Rowdy the Warrior, who ran third, is one that I'd be looking at moving out of this race. You know, the uncontested was obviously loose on the lead. Rowdy the Warrior is kind of the second time now he hasn't really gotten a favorable setup. Yeah, I know they were running, but the horse was loose and it had really no pressure. So Rowdy the Warrior, as the distances kind of get a little bit longer, is one that I might want underneath in some of the later races down at Oaklawn.
There was a little bit of extra three-year-old action over the weekend, thinking specifically of out in Southern California, a horse that you are a big fan of, I know, JK, or were going into the race, Dabster, making his return to the races. Who ended up winning that race?
Dabster did. I was famously DQ'd on opening day. Not famously, but infamously, I guess. It wasn't a very – I would have hit the pick five that day, and Dabster got taken down deservedly. And then yesterday the inquiry sign came up and I was like, oh, cause he did look like he came out a little bit at the stretch, at the top of the stretch. And I was like, oh my God, he's coming down again. But they weren't even looking at him. They were looking at someone else. I think the story of that race was Surfside Sunset. I think a lot of people expected him to run well off of the debut where he broke poorly and was running at another Baffert trainee, American Anthem, that is highly regarded, and Surfside Sunset got to one of those tricky trips and didn't really run that well. But Dabster was good. He looked like he was beat at the 3/8, and especially at about the 8th pole, he looked like he was beat, and he just kept finding.
There was another super impressive performance from a Bob Baffert runner this weekend, a 3-year-old out at Santa Anita. Mike, tell us a little bit about Valiant Minister.
Well, Valiant Minister was, like you said, a 4-year-old debuting for Bob Baffert. Baffert had another horse in the race. I believe it was a morning line favorite was a Baffert horse as well. There was a first-timer for Peter Miller. And the other Baffert had run a couple times, hit the board, I think, and was the morning line favorite. The moment the betting opened, everything was on Valiant Minister. Every other horse in the race was cold. I think the horse opened at, Jonathan, you may know, 6-5, even money, something like that. Maybe even flirted with below even money for a little while. Drifted up late, I think, ended up going up to 3-2 at one point before coming back down to even money. And long story short, he ran like an even money horse. And I think, Jonathan, you said a 99 buyer in the debut?
Yeah, that's what I heard. I didn't see it on paper yet, but I've heard it a few times. But
I can pull that up.
Something interesting about this type of situation is that the way that he ran that 6-furlong race was obviously pretty impressive with that big figure. It's going to be interesting to see what they do with this horse. You know, if it was a 3-year-old, mm-hmm. we know what would happen next, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe they would sprint him one more time, and then they would stretch him out because he's a 3-year-old, and you have to do that if you're a good 3-year-old in Bob Baffert's barn. These are the types of horses that Bob Baffert wins the sprint championship with and things like that, where he's not really forced to do that. I heard him actually this morning on Steve Bick, and he said that he's not really sure what he's going to do with him. He thinks he'll sprint him again, and then maybe he'll stretch him out. The candy ride part of it kind of made him think that he would go a little bit longer, but if he's got any upside off of that performance, I think it's pretty special.
What do you do, Jonathan, when you're reacting to a horse who puts up a figure like that first out? It always makes me a little bit nervous about the ability to stay together when they debut with that big of a number. The fact that this is a 4-year-old, does that mitigate it somewhat, or does it give you a little bit of pause?
No, not really. You know, typically what I'll do is like I said, I try to jump on DRF and read quotes. I was fortunate enough, like I said this morning, to be listening to our pal Steve Vick, and Baffert said something in that interview that will make me put a note on this horse, and I don't care who he's racing in next time. If a little bit of an improve makes him lay over the field, I'll single and build everything around him. And that is that Garcia came back, and Baffert was expecting Garcia to say, oh, wow, what a horse. Wow, how good is he? And he came back, and he said, he's so green. He was looking all over the place. and Baffert was like looking all, he went 108 and change. He was looking all over the place. So those are the types of things that help me lean on short price horses to build around. And if there's, so that suggests there'll be some improvement there for that horse. And next time he runs, I'll be expecting it.
I got a couple other points on Valiant Minister before we move on. First, he was a pretty pricey two-year-old in training sale, and I'm going through in Formulator. You can do this. You can pull up lifetime workouts, and then you can go into any of the Bob Baffert runners and look at Valiant Minister. You'll see that he had a number of gaps in his work tab. He was purchased as a two-year-old in training in 2015. He was working in 2015 a few times, and then sent to the sidelines in September of 2015, and didn't work again until March of last year, then was nearly ready, it looks to me, was working 6 furlong works through May, cut back to a 4 furlong work on June 1st. Something must have gone wrong because he'd worked about 8 to 10 works straight every week in between, like clockwork. And then he didn't work again until November. So I don't know if it was a major issue, Jonathan, either on the interview. Go ahead.
He said minor issues. That's one. He said no surgeries, just minor little stuff. Nagging things. Yeah. Just kind of nagging things that were an issue.
Yeah, and then came back in November and again was working every 7 to 8 days like clockwork until the debut. And then the one other thing I'll say is I think that there's a little bit of a conception about, or perception rather, about both Baffert and Pletcher with debuting two-year-olds versus older horses. And this is where I love something like Formulator, because I went in prior to the race. I think I mentioned to both of you that I've been giving some stats to your buddy Tom Quigley to mention on the Santa Anita simulcast. And one of the things I looked at was Baffert debuting older horses. I looked at all the four-year-old first-time starters Baffert has had in the last 5 years. He had 11 of them prior to Valiant Minister, and 6 of them won. So Baffert's now 7 for 11 debuting four-year-olds, which is pretty amazing considering how really I think the public thinks of him as a trainer who's so good at getting these two-year-olds ready to crank. You would think that maybe it's not quite his strong suit to get these older ones ready.
I didn't realize you were out in that role, Mike. I thought it was more of a Cyrano de Bergerac situation. So I hadn't highlighted it.
I think he's mentioning me on air a little bit now and then, or at least he's mentioning DRF Formulator, which I think most people know I'm a beard for, so.
There you go. Well, I thought that Jonathan's point about, you both make excellent points about using Formulator for this, spending a lot of time on Valiant Minister, but there's a lot of points to be made, especially regarding Formulator. Jonathan mentioned about the ability to hunt down trainer quotes, either in the excellent articles you're going to read on DRF.com if you're a DRF Plus member, or also a regular listener to the Steve Bick Show, as I've said many times on this program and on at the races. I think there's no better or faster way to become a horse racing insider than to be a regular listener to that show, and also somebody who regularly reads the great work of the DRF team of reporters that you can get via DRF Plus. You can get pretty in pretty quick. And to be able to take that information and make your own past performances via Formulator that much more bright and in color by having right in the running lines of your PPs some of these quotes from a guy like Baffert. The other thing that strikes me about this horse is I think I'd be more inclined, based on everything I know right now, to be serious about this horse as a contender in the sprint division, just because we've seen these sort of, I mean, maybe it's an exaggeration to call him ouchie, but you know, he's clearly a horse who's had some issues, minor though they may be. But we've seen over and over again with sprinters, they tend to excel off. You could see a lot of layoff lines, no problem in the sprint division. I wonder if that's where this horse's future is going to be. But, you know, just one of the many stories we'll be following along throughout 2017 on the road to the Breeders' Cup. Let's talk a little bit more about racing from the weekend. You guys did a good job on Friday, nearly gave out a $30 double, which we were beat out of by Justin Nose. Let's talk back to some of those races and what happened, starting off with let's start off with the fifth season, I guess. Jonathan, what did you think of the result from there?
Well, I tell you, if today someone told me that today is opposite day, so if today is opposite day, then Mr. Z won.
Jonathan, I'm kicking myself because right after the podcast, I'm like, oh man, I missed a perfect opportunity for a head-to-head bet. I didn't know if my pick was going to win, but I knew Chief of Staff was beating Mr. Z.
I was in Jake, my buddy Jake Ballas's kitchen, and Jake was texting Pete. Did he just pick Mr. Z?
This happened during the. I noticed it just as we went off the air. I would have used it on air in Friday's show. Jake texted me that Jonathan should never be allowed on the DRF Players podcast again. So horrendous was his pick of Mr. Z. And that's from one of his friends. Imagine what JK's critics were saying.
Oh boy, yeah. I don't think I have anything more to add to that one.
Who won that? Well, tell us who won the race, Jonathan, and tell me if you have any excuses.
I honestly don't know who won the race. I just know that Mr. Z was last.
Domain's Rap was the name of the horse that won. Who's a little bit of a popular older horse. I think he was a claimer at one point. He's won some races at Oaklawn. So I think even though he was a little bit of a long shot, and frankly, the board in there was perhaps part of the story in the race. Mr. Z opened as the favorite, which is just insane to me. And then he floated up a little bit, but there were a lot of 5, 6, 7, 8 to 1 horses. And I think Domain's Rap might've been right in the higher end of those odds.
That race actually wasn't in the Tough Beat Double, was it? I think that one started with the Fort Lauderdale. Does that sound right, Mike?
Yes, I believe so. Well, I know in the Fort Lauderdale, I don't know about the Tough Beat Double. I know Jonathan and I were both on the same horse, Chad Brown's other runner, Night Prowler, being the shorter of the two prices, Almanar or some strange name like that, who ran huge, and I thought for a second we had it, and then we got nosed out at the wire by a horse that, Jonathan, you noted prior to us going on air was a clocker play, actually, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, our buddy actually Joe Metka used Flatline. Philly Joe used Flatline in the tournament, and I asked, I was like, "What? Why?" Because I forgot that he had a B+ in the DRF Clocker report, B+ workout going into the race. And so, what Pete was referring to on the bad beat double there was, I did a 2x1 double. I used Almanar and Divisadero to Tommy Macho, and I dutched it for either way it would have come. It was a 13-1 return. I turned that situation into 13-1, and obviously Tommy Macho won the next race pretty impressively, actually. But Almanar was beat a nose, and Divisadero got the trip I thought he was going to get.
Any excited to bet Divisadero next time? What are you thinking there?
Yeah, I think he's always going to be up against it at that racetrack. He just seems like he's always in the clear. He's always three wide. It just, you know, I mean, unless Joe Bravo's riding him, I don't see him getting down to the rail and tipping out. So, you know, I'll give him another shot. I thought he ran really well. I'm excited about the year that he's going to have, especially when he starts getting a different racetrack and more, you know, that pace scenario wasn't not honest, but it wasn't exactly fast. So, I think he'll be fine. I'll bet him back wherever he's at, especially if he has a similar setup.
Yeah, I was sort of envisioning him not running at Gulfstream again, but I guess you're right. The Gulfstream meet goes so long, it's so early in the year, it could be more of the same in terms of problems for him. But, you know.
I mean, probably one more time? He'll probably run the Gulfstream Park Handicap, that race that Point of Entry and Animal Kingdom ran against each other in, and then I would imagine they would point to the Derby Day race, right?
Yeah, that would make sense to me, and that might be more his game when you get down to it. Any further thoughts on Tommy Macho? That was indeed what I was referring to. You guys both had given out Almanar, and then there was JK was super strong on Tommy Macho in the next.
I just as a race watcher, if you like to think that you are one, or if you want to get better at it, just watch the race and watch the dynamics of it. I literally turned and walked away from the TV when he was all in at the 3/8. I thought,
you thought you were beat.
He's going to run fourth.
In running betting would have been interesting in that race, that's for sure.
I thought he's going to run fourth. Then he starts finding on the inside, and by the time they get to the 8th pole, he's clear, and it was never in doubt that he was going to win, and he's extending on his wrong lead and runs a triple-digit buyer.
What do you do with that for future analysis? See, I that's a little tough to me. A horse that hasn't necessarily shown those kind of qualities that are not positive qualities when you're race watching, going forward, those in my gut are not the ones I'm looking for to improve. Am I being too cynical, Mike?
I would expect this horse to have a number of works, maybe even a little bit of a time off between races, and they deal with whatever issue it was that kept him from changing leads. And then you trust in a trainer like Bob Baffert. I mean, I think if instead they said, okay, look, there's one spot left in the Pegasus and we're going to take a shot with Tommy Macho coming back in a few weeks and running, you know, that's the kind of play that I'm 100% against, especially at a short price. It's the firing line in the Preakness play. But I would imagine Baffert's going to do right by the horse, get whatever issue that might be implied by a lack of changing leads, get that taken care of. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a little bit of a short layoff from him.
You know, it's one of those I'm glad I was at the wedding situations.
Yeah,
I just sure. I can't see myself getting on a horse off of a performance like that when they're all in at the 3/8, they look dead and they come back. I mean, I think he was fortunate to win the race, and obviously was something wasn't right where I don't know if it was Johnny or Javier. I'm assuming it was one of I think it was Luis Saez. It was one of those three guys felt like they needed to push and pedal like a bike the entire race. So. Definitely not one I want. Something I want. I'm going to bet out of that.
Oh, that makes sense. What about other races over the course of the weekend, guys? Anything else catch your eye in terms of horses to add to a watch list, or should we move on and maybe take a quick little preview look at the Pegasus?
I don't have anything else to add, Jonathan. And I know you probably were following a little more closely than I was, at least at the time.
No, I just feel like I need to regain some of my confidence by my Mr. Z pick and just pointing out that I was right at Aqueduct with Yorkie Poo Princess.
You were. That's right. Good job, Chalk Boy.
I need some kind of confidence builder of some sort. So
I'm like, helping.
And might I add though, if you haven't been watching Aqueduct, Gold Rail almost the entire weekend, and that horse was not on the Gold Rail. That horse might be pretty good.
All right, good stuff there. Good stuff from the gang. The Pegasus shaping up to be some pretty interesting sport as the return, the rematch, I guess we should say, between Arigate and California Chrome. Very much looking forward to it. It's going to be very fun out at the NHC to be in a room with 700 horse players watching it. There's been some news breaking about other entrants in the field. At this point, we're getting pretty close. How close are we to having all 12 of those gates filled? Who are either of you guys up to the latest news on the Pegasus?
I think it's 11. I don't know. I can pull up an article while we're talking. I can pull up Matt Haggerty, I believe, wrote an article about some of the newest additions, most notably Rallis, as to no one's surprise. We knew Redham had a spot in the Pegasus. We knew it wasn't going to be by Nyquist. We knew Donworth was nowhere to be seen as far as the work tab goes. So we knew neither one of them, even though that was plan A and plan B back when they bought the $1 million entry. I think they had to go with plan C, which is a turf horse in Rallis, now running on the dirt in the Pegasus. So there was that news. And then the other news was evidently a fantastic work by one Prayer for Relief ended up getting Dale Romans and Ahmed Zayat very excited about the prospect of running this horse against California Chrome, against Arrogate, and against 10 other horses, 9 other horses, I guess, for a share of 1 million, or I guess they're probably looking at what, best case scenario, third, right?
What is the purse structure again, JK? I know you've said it on the show before, so I'm giving it to you, hoping it's at the tip of your brain.
No, it's not. I think it's like 7 it. Million, 2 million, something like that. While he's doing that, I will say this. Prayer for Relief has been working well for 3 years, and I have at least 5 digits worth of money that I would like to have back. Betting him in exotic pick fours, pick fives, pick sixes. Because he's been working lights out, and he never picks up his feet.
Well, he, right. You know, Frank Scatoni had the line on him, and I've seen others repeat it on Twitter, but he's the one who I heard call him this first, and it just continues to ring true. Prayer for class relief.
Yeah, well, sure. And this is a horse who last time he hit the board in North America was the Hal's Hope 2 years and 1 week ago, running third to Lee and Confrontation. Then he went to Dubai. He's not hit the board in his last two starts since he returned for Dubai, when he ran in the Fayette, where he was fifth, beaten 16 lengths, and in the Clark, where he was ninth, beaten 33 lengths, and beat only one horse. That was the aforementioned Mr. Z. So, yeah, that's all I have to say about Prayer for Relief, but he's going to be in the starting
game. At the same time, when you're looking at the economics of this situation, it might make sense to take a shot. Now, what did one of you guys dig up the purse?
Well, I believe it's $7 million for the winner, 1.75 or $2 million. I don't remember exactly. I don't have it in front of me. For second, third is a flat mil, and then they recently announced, this is another within the last week or so, another announcement where they've juiced up fourth and fifth after. Originally, after third place, all other runners are getting back 250,000 of the original million put up. But now they've juiced up an additional 350,000. I believe it's 200 for extra for fourth place, and a 150 extra for third, or sorry, for fifth place.
Fourth and fifth, yeah.
Yeah. So that's at least a little bit more appealing for some of those that put up the million and were looking, if not finishing in the money, of only getting back 250.
Jonathan, this race is going to be part of the NHC card. Do you see a world in which you'll make the Pegasus? And we'll talk about this more when we have actual PPs, etc. But do you see a world in which you'd make the Pegasus one of your optional plays if it's not a mandatory race?
Absolutely. On Saturday, we actually talked about this in our group text that I always talk about on here. Dan Kovaleski brought up the point, like, what if you're like, you know, you're on the bubble and you've got three plays left. Like, what's wrong with that $5 of making sure you make the top 50?
Well, you say that like the winner is that obvious, is it? I feel like it's a coin flip to get that $5. I mean, from this far out, what do you think?
Well, yes, from this far out, absolutely.
$280 is guaranteed, but I don't know about $5.
But not if Chrome draws the rail.
Right.
You know,
it's a different
ball game, yeah, after the draw and see what happens. But, you know, yeah. I don't think so. I doubt it's a race that's playable. But I also wouldn't be surprised if the NTRA makes it a mandatory. I mean, I know that some people would scoff at that. Like, why would they do that? I think it's an interesting race. And I think that if they did make it a mandatory, the handicapping comes into play. Because in that room, Keen Ice and horses like War Story would be one third of their tote price in the room, if you know what I'm saying. Maybe there's a better way to explain that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that concept for a minute. A contest has – there's two different ways that value exists in a contest. One is the normal way of the price on the board and the award you're going to get for picking a certain winner versus – the chances you've handicapped of that horse winning. That sort of value, as we understand it every day at the races. In a contest, it changes a little bit because you're also, if you'll forgive the unintentional pun, jockeying for position within the contest. So certain horses, the horse might be 20-1 on the board, but he's everybody's wise guy horse, and he's essentially the equivalent of 3-1 in the room. You hit him, you know, that's good. You don't fall behind any, but you don't get as much of the benefit because so many other of the players in the room are going to have that horse. Is that what am I spelling out what you were getting at there, JK?
100%. If you want to see something grumpy, you walk by a table when a bomb wins and everyone has them, and you'll hear me or someone else say, oh God, that horse was 3-1 in the room where he was 15-1 on the tote board. I tell you what, there's a horse I'll never forget. He's the most overbet. I'm not gonna remember his name, so let me abort the story. But there was a horse that ran in California that was in a mandatory race, and I swear to you, 80% of the room played the horse, and he got the worst trip ever and ran fourth. and I mean everyone played this horse. I cannot Perez rode him.
It was a down the hill. Oh, it was a horse.
It was a turf race.
Yes.
And the horse just kept getting bad. Oh, Patriot Bay or Patriots Rule.
Patriots Rule. The name.
Patriots Rule.
Boom. That's it.
That horse, I swear.
I agree with you. I was in another part of the room from you at a monitor with five guys, four of them screaming for this horse. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, yes, I'm sure it would have been good for you guys to hit that. But imagine the, you know, it's not the separator. It's still important. It's not like you're going to regret that you had it. You didn't fall behind, but you didn't get the benefit. And then the opposite situation, I think, and this is where the Dan Kovaleski example, I don't know if he was, when he made it, he was tipping Arigate or Chrome, but the idea that these short-priced horses, especially in a contest with 650 people, they take on a lot of extra importance because even if you just get $5, if it's $5 that puts you over 30 other people, and in a 600-runner field, 650-runner field, it might be more than that that it vaults you over. Then when the next winner comes and you have it and the people behind you have it, you're still in front instead of getting blocked, instead of being behind, instead of still always chasing. So sometimes in a contest, that kind of contrarian thinking can actually do you very well. Now, let's talk for a second about whether or not the Pegasus is going to be a mandatory race. I've had the pleasure of sitting in with the folks who pick these mandatory races. They are friend of the podcast, longtime moderator at the NHC, Eric Wing is one of the guys. Tony Neville, who runs the sports book at Treasure Island, since the contest went to TI, he's been in that room. And then, of course, the national handicapper for Daily Racing Form, Mike Watchmaker, is the third guy. And I sat and watched them do it. And it's interesting because it's different than people might think. Let me tell you, I'll just be perfectly honest about this, not mean to criticize the NTRA. Just if it were up to me to pick the mandatory races, I think my default mode would be I'm going to pick the best races on the day. You know, I might think twice about one odds on favorite or a short field or something like that, but that would be my default mode. The instructions that those men get from the NTRA are not those. The instructions they get are to present a survey of what American racing is. And that's why you will see a $5,000 claimer from Fairgrounds in there because, you know, claiming races, bread and butter of American racing, you're looking to put a survey of American racing, you're going to have a low-level claimer in there. I think the guys, when they pick that race, are doing the job they're assigned to do. They're doing their job correctly. However, given the mandate that they have, if it were up to me, that would just not be their mandate. Now, the way that I look at the world, I feel like the Pegasus would clearly be in there. Even though you have these two overwhelming favorites, it's a big full field. It's an exciting race. It's not one horse. It's two horses. You at least have to choose between them. Like, that's handicapping. That should be part of the NHC in the way that I look at the world. However, if your mandate is to create this survey situation, you know, you can't have every race be from Gulfstream, right? And you're going to have a 12-horse race at Gulfstream, 12-horse turf race, super competitive, you know, that kind of thing. And you're there with their mandate, they may well default towards that. What would you guys do if it were up to you, starting with you, JK?
Yeah, well, let me paint a picture for you, right? It's like handicapping, what it is. When people ask you, because I know everyone's had to answer it before, handicapping, what does that mean? You have to explain it to them. And essentially what you tell them is I look at past situations with racing and evaluate today's conditions and how the race will unfold and who the most likely winner is and what situation presents the most value based on all that stuff. That's kind of that's the best way to explain it. To me, evaluating who is going to win the $12 million Pegasus with two of the best horses in America that are arguably going to go head and toe for horse of the year, and evaluating what's going to happen in that race in terms of post position, trainer statistics, pedigree, past performance, all those things. To me, that's a truer indicator of handicapping ability versus a $5,000 claimer at Oaklawn where 12 horses have shipped in. There's 8 horses off layoffs. That is more of a value guessing game to me than a handicapping situation. And I don't understand what the problem is with a $6 horse. Like, tournament players like act like that's this nasty thing, and that if you're not picking $12, $15, $25 horses, that it's somehow not a great race opportunity. And I just don't believe that.
Mike, as somebody who's a little more, you know, neutral in all this, what's your take on it?
Well, you know, I completely agree with Jonathan to an extent, but I'll also say this. I think a race like the Pegasus is completely unique compared to nearly every other race that the selectors are going to be presented with. And by that, I mean, this is the focus of the racing world, especially on this day. But I mean, we're even talking about it weeks out. We talked about it weeks ago. This is the focus. As soon as Arrogate beat Chrome in the Classic, and we heard that they were both going to run in the Pegasus, this has been the focus of the racing world. And as a national handicapping championship, which is about handicapping horse races, to me, it seems like it would be a very big miss if we do not use this big race, where Jonathan is absolutely right. You can make a case for either of the top two. You can, even if you need to, make a crazy case for one of the others at least hitting the board and presenting additional value. If they don't pick this race, I think it seems like this competition and this championship is a little bit of out of lockstep with the racing world, in my opinion.
That's a fair point. I mean, it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, again, given their mandate, I won't question them if they don't do it. People can still play it as an optional. Sure. It's not like saying, oh, you can't use – it's not excluding it from the contest. That would be out of step. With so many optional plays, you know, I wouldn't be critical knowing – having sat there while they essentially went over their instructions. I would get it if they don't.
For those that have never been, when there's a mandatory race on at the NHC, it's exciting. Everyone is watching because everyone has a play. When the random third race at Tampa runs, there's seven guys that are screaming because they bet something, right? But for a mandatory, everyone stops, everyone watches, and the room is very, very electric.
Right.
How cool would it be? How cool would it be if this race comes on, everyone's watching it, everyone's rooting? To me, if the NTRA wants media coverage and they want footage of being able to plug it into YouTube things and commercials, like that's the moment you want on TV.
Yep. 100%. That's exactly my point, Jonathan. You articulated it much better than I did.
All right. Well, let's move on to a question about the NHC. This one is from is it Brad Sabo? I got his name wrong.
Chad.
I did get it wrong.
Chad
Sabo. Apologies, Chad. And he had some questions about coming up with a plan for qualifying for next year's NHC, for the 2018 NHC, on a budget. And mostly a weekend player, not a big budget at all for you know, compared to the average tournament player, I'd say. He's looking to spend about $200 a month, and was just curious, JK, to get some advice in what the best way to approach trying to qualify for the NHC would be. I have a few thoughts, but why don't you go first?
I had this conversation with someone the other day. I would go to DRF tournaments. I don't know what you mean by budget. I don't know how much money you want to spend. One thing I would do, what I would do is I would play on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I would play the $18, $22, whatever it is, feeders for into the I don't know the exact dollar amount, $18, $20, $23,
$24, whatever. Depends on the week.
I would play those to feed into Saturday. So you're never having to put up the big 165. You just put the 18 up. Now, what I would do to take that to the next level is I would play a $20 matchup and the $20 feeder. And the idea is that you might not be good enough that day to beat the 30 guys, but you can probably beat the one guy and break even on the day. And then you just do that every week until you know. You'd be playing on Saturday more often than you'd think without having to invest the entire $165. Hopefully you do well enough in your matchups that you can kind of cancel it out and pay for it.
The key to that is if you're more of a weekend player, that those during the week events are all in contests, meaning all picks have to be in before the start of the first race. You could do all your work on that the night before, essentially, sort of, you know, in a perfect world, you'd go back through after scratches, etc. But if you had to, you can put in there, put in some alternate picks, get post-time favorites if you end up getting hosed in that regard. So you could do it without spending. I mean, I one question I did not ask was how much time he spends handicapping a race typically, but assuming he can go through that process fairly quickly, you could definitely make that strategy work. Additionally, I'd suggest that, you know, very obvious, but you're going to want to play in all of those NTRA free events, and not only to try to have your miracle day and finish in the top few of the 2,000 people who play in those, but to get tour points. You know, let's say there's 2,000 runners, top 200 get tour points. Between following Jonathan's plan and hopefully getting a few high scores in weekend events on DRF tournaments, and also having some scores from the NTRA qualifiers, all of a sudden you're going to create not only a front door possibility of qualifying directly and walking right into the NHC, but also have the opportunity to get in via the tour, which shouldn't be discounted as another way to do it. So I think that pretty much covers it. Anything else leap to your mind, JK, in terms of advice for somebody trying to get into the NHC on a budget? Are there any other specific tournaments you've noticed particular value in, et cetera, that he might want to consider?
I'll say it. I've said it a million times. One of my favorite tournaments of the entire year is the tournaments they have at Hawthorne. I think that they're $300, $350 or whatever, and you can bet whatever you want. There's no minimums. There's no maximums. So it resembles kind of what you do on a normal day. Chicago's in the middle of the earth, so that's easy for most people to get to, no matter where you're coming from. And so I really like that event. So that, and it's kind of a lower live bankroll event. So that always works too.
You're saying they've got an airport in Chicago, Jonathan?
I believe they do.
And I think that, right, I mean, obviously that's a little over the budget we talked about. But, you know, maybe that's the kind of thing where you put aside some of that money if you've been able to make some matchup money, for example, or, you know, you have some sort of hit where it's a chance to stretch. Maybe that's a place he'd want to do it. He also asked about, and this is sort of a good general question, the advantages and disadvantages of playing smaller tracks. I don't think this was limited only to talking about tournaments. I think cash play could be considered as well. Mike, do you have anything that leaps to your head about the advantages or disadvantages of playing in smaller tracks?
I do. I mean, I think from a cash play standpoint, I'm going to imagine by smaller tracks, he means tracks with not just smaller purses, but also potentially smaller handle. And with that comes a little bit more volatility, which is both good and bad, depending upon which side of the equation you land on. Because at a smaller track where the pools tend to be smaller, you might be betting a horse at 5-1 as they're loading into the gate, who then either drifts up much more than they would at a bigger track or gets hammered much more than you could expect at, say, you know, the Aqueduct or Belmont or Saratoga or Santa Anita, for example. But you can sometimes use that to your advantage, especially if you're able to dabble in other pools, get alive in pick threes. Sometimes at smaller tracks, there might be maybe less sophisticated bettors. And so sometimes that offers a little bit more value and you're not playing against some of the biggest bettors in the game.
Makes perfect sense. JK, what do you think about that question?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Mike said. I think the trickiest part is the pool size. you know, it just most moves that you make in those situations, they can sometimes, you know, affect it. It's just kind of the way that it works.
I don't think that's an issue, though, for somebody at this bankroll level. I don't think that's a negative that you need to worry too much about.
Well, I mean, if you're, you know, say you're going to bet an exacta and you're going to key a horse on top and you bet a $20 exacta, or, you know, and it's a $40 bet, you know, it's not that significant, but like, you know, Delta Downs on a Saturday night, it could be tricky. But you're probably right. Not as much as you would think. But here's one thing that I do think is probably a disadvantage. And it's kind of a little bit of an opposite view than what Mike had. I actually do think that because the pools are so small, the sophisticated bettors stand out more in those places. I think that the
sure
that because you know it's there's not as much money kind of masked in there, and those kind of sharks can come in and really really pluck it out of there, and I think that that makes it a little bit of a challenge.
I've got a perfect example of that, and this is a bigger track, but it's something I don't know if you saw me tweet this out. It was last week, I believe it was on Thursday at Gulfstream. In the feature race, there was a turf sprint. There was a Bill Mott favorite who ended up wiring the field. But there was a horse who was 15-1 on the morning line and went off at, I think, 12-1 or so, that was the seventh choice in the betting, was the seventh choice in the morning line, was the seventh choice in the double will pays, but was hammered down to the clear favorite in the pick three will pays. And if you were paying attention and you noticed it, that horse ran very, very well, ended up getting beat for third. The Mott runner was ready to go and ended up airing. But this bettor, whoever it was, and maybe it was a group of bettors, honed in on a horse that was ready to run and ran a big race, albeit in defeat, at a nice price. And so that's the sort of thing at smaller tracks especially you see even more of.
I think the bigger point to me about specializing isn't so much about big track, small track, but just that idea we talked about a little bit last week about how much more in tune you can get with every aspect of racing when you have a main focus. Some people, Kinchin, great multitasker, can have a track that he's sort of completely stuck into, doing all the trip notes, etc., and still be paying attention to three other tracks. Very, very useful. One of the many reasons why he's a fine tournament player. For me, I kind of need to focus on one track if I'm going to be doing my A-plus job. If I'm even looking at that other stuff, it's gonna be hard for me to notice the rider who's heating up, the barn who's heating up, the subtleties of the bias that day, to be able to spend the time that I need to properly do the race review that I want to do and the trip notes that I want to do. To really get the best out of myself as a horse player. I started off, I mean, my Saratoga was the perfect example of this for me. I started off that meet completely focused up until I'd say, I wonder if this is a coincidence. About up until you rolled into town, JK, I was super focused on that meet and went on a terrific run, which then it wasn't just you. It was, I think, having every contest player in America come through for the Naira Saratoga contest and spending more nights in a row than I should have going out and not enough nights working. I'll be honest. I don't think I ever caught up.
I would like to think that the turnaround happened on your birthday when you ended up swimming in your neighbor's pool.
Did we ever tell that story on the podcast? That's absolutely true story. We were having some fun that night. We had a good day at the races. And I blame Desiree for this one personally. We were set up. We had a nice little thing going in the backyard. We had my friend, Chef Dan Spitz, over. He was making pizzas in the pizza oven. The music was going. The drinks were flowing. And Desiree egged me on. The neighbors were sitting there. They had one of those little cocktail pools in the backyard. She egged me on to go and see if I could swim in it. And somehow I did. And there's video evidence of this, actually, somewhere on the internet that exists. It's not quite not safe for work, but I still think it's probably not a bad idea to hide the women and children before you click on that particular link. But yeah, you might be right. I never came. It was very refreshing on the 90-degree night, but the handicapping never improved. But the good news is when you're focused on a circuit, those are some of the benefits you can get. And then if you can just, you know, have the discipline to not go swimming in your neighbor's pool, maybe you can keep that going for an entire meet and make a little bit of money. We are running out of time here, gentlemen, but we have a couple other things I want to talk about. I think you want to talk about, too. Let's do them in the form of final thoughts. Mike Hogan, we'll start with you.
My final thought is actually a question that came, or a comment that came from our regular listener, Elliot Honecker, who is listening live right now as he's driving to Cincinnati. So hello, Elliot, and thanks for sending me this text. Hopefully you pulled over before you texted me, making the note about if the Pegasus is a mandatory, Elliot, Jonathan, and many others will get two picks in there. So my question is for Jonathan. You're sitting with a mandatory with two entries. presuming that they're both kind of similar, what do you do? Do you go all in on one? Do you split your picks? How do you approach it?
I know the answer to this one.
Jonathan, but yeah, I'm wondering how many will approach it.
Well, I think the biggest question and the biggest part of it is where I'm at. Okay, if I'm doing well, things are going well, and I'm close to making the cut late on Saturday, then I'm going to use Chrome or Arrogant, whichever one I ultimately decide is going to win. My lean right now is Arrogant, but obviously there's a lot of things that have to happen. So I would use, if they're identical, I would use them on both. However, if I'm in a spot where I'm like right on the edge with both of them and I need $6 to get in, then I would use Chrome on one and Arrogant on the other. That's one strategy that I might do. If I'm just doing awful and I'm struggling, I'm going to use War Story on one and Keen Ice on the other. And it just depends on where I'm at. That's what's kind of tricky about this tournament and this situation is there's so many different places that you can be in the tournament to determine where you're going to go.
That's a great point, though, about how you have to be flexible when it comes to especially late game tournament strategy. I mean, we always talk about the great Paul Sherman line about play who you like, and that's right at many points throughout a tournament, but in terms of strategy, especially multi-ticket strategy, that's where I think you got to try at least to take it to the next level.
Well, let me put some words in Jonathan's mouth for a second here. Jonathan's going to play what he likes, but it's going to depend upon where he's at. I mean, he's identified that on certain tickets he's got chalk, be it Arrogant or Chrome, whichever he decides he favors. And then on others, if he needs it, he's going to play a live long shot. That horse may be Keen Ice, it may be War Story, but he's not going to reach for a horse that he doesn't think is going to hit the board just because it's a price, right?
And yeah, and let me not – I don't want to mislead people. It won't be War Story. War Story rode a gold rail last time. It won't be him. It was just a name I popped up.
Sure,
I don't want to mislead anyone that that's a horse I'm interested in. Sure. Yeah, no, and it's, what's probably going to happen, what's most likely to happen if I am doing well is that I'll have one that's doing well, one that's not. The one that's doing well, I'll play the most likely winner, whether it be Chrome or Arrogant, and the other one I'll fire away with someone that's that could, if something crazy happens, then that becomes my good ticket and that could get me to day two or day three, excuse me.
Contests are hard because sometimes you have to hold these seemingly contradictory thoughts in your head at the same time. On one hand, play who you like. On another hand, being willing to be flexible depending on the situation. But those are the kind of problems you have to solve if you want to be a successful contest player. Jonathan, we have time for a quick final thought from you.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind everyone, I don't know who all got the email. I'm going to tweet it out. I'm going to tag you guys in it too. But the NTRA is making a lot of ground with getting the phrase, the amount of the wager, cleared up with the Treasury Department. And they have a 31-page document that's in the Treasury Department, and we just need to kind of push it through. It's going the right direction. And so they set up a little link. I think it's ntra.com/comment, where you can kind of fill out a thing and it will send this response. And we obviously just want to send as many of those as possible so that they know we mean business. And so we'll tweet that out. But when you get a chance, make sure you do that. For those that don't know what it is, the basic idea is that our tax laws in terms of wagering are just a little bit old. They're not really built for the new age of the multi-race bets, the exotic bets we have. And essentially, a lot of money is being taken out of circulation and kind of given to the government as an interest-free loan. And it'd be better for us as horse players if we could keep that money in our pockets and keep that money kind of churning around. And the NTRA has done a great job to push that along. So if you get a chance, it's really easy. You just kind of click it, put your information. There's already a pre-typed in kind of statement, and you can add to it or subtract or whatever, and just send that over.
Yes,
takes
super
less
quick.
Than a minute. Yeah,
and I'd like to point out, JK, not only you are right, the government is currently getting an interest-free loan, and I'm sure there's benefits of that, but in the long term, they'll make more money too, because more money will be bet, thus increasing the cut for the whole for everybody, racetracks, horsemen, horse players, the government. Seriously, everybody wins. This is something the NTRA have been working on for a long time, pushing this particular boulder up a hill, and they are near the top, and we can help push them over. So go check that out. You can get the information on ntra.com. We'll be sending Twitter messages as well. And that's all the time we have for today's show, gentlemen. We will be back on Friday. We're going to talk about races coming up in the weekend. We'll also finalize our schedule for NHC week. Not sure what was going on there. Some crazy rattling, but that's okay.
I want the dice fall where they may.
It was. You're sort of rolling them out there. Don't get snake eyes. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank Mike Hogan, as always, as well as the DRF production team. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. We'll be back on Friday. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.